The following is a part of the Radio Memphis On Demand service. It originally aired live on Radio Memphis and has been edited for time.
And there you have it. Turn Me Over. And that is from Einstein 2 right here on Radio Memphis. You're tuned into Memphis Metal Mondays with me, Dirty D, and I'm hanging out with my guest co-host, Mr. Phil Berger. And we played that song. We dug into the vault. We played it for a reason. It's because there's a particular guitar player that is on that track. Now, that guitar player is a very seasoned veteran, and he is probably one of the most versatile guitar players around. His spectrum of guitar playing goes anywhere from thrash metal to soul funk. He does some melodic madness. You guys know Al Petrelli, better known with him as far as being with Trans-Siberian Orchestra. You also know him from Megadeth, Alice Cooper, Joe Lynn Turner. He's done stuff with Asia, Sabotage. But what you don't realize is that how well-versed and how well-rounded he is, because his resume also includes working with Taylor Dane, Lita Ford. He's done stuff with Kathy Tricoli, Exposé, Doro, Michael Bolton, along with jamming with some of the coolest progressive bands around. And that really is just the tip of the iceberg. Not only has he worked with majors, he's done a ton of indie stuff, hence why he's talking to Radio Memphis. And yeah, you heard that right. As a musical director, a renowned session and touring musician, as well as a teacher, we know that he probably has a lot of great experiences that he can share with us and a ton of words of wisdom. And so, with no further ado, we are so excited that we finally have Mr. Al Petrelli with us live right here on Radio Memphis. How are you doing, buddy?
How are you, darling? Good to hear your voice.
It is so fantastic. I am so glad that you have finally had the chance to catch up with us.
Oh, my God. After that buildup, I don't know what to say.
Well, look.
Good Lord. I sound like really important and really old right now.
Look, I was trying to cover all the bases, man.
Yeah, you done good.
So that we can get down to the nitty gritty and the dirt. Because really, I just want dirt from you.
I possess a lot of that as well.
Oh, no. And like I said, you're talking to us here. I'm Diana, and you're talking to Phil right here in Radio Memphis. I was so excited, when I knew that we were going to have the opportunity. And I don't know if you realize this or not. There was a time when Trans-Siberian Orchestra, when they first were really getting their go, and they actually, what they did as a gift, they gave out some platinum records, okay, to some radio DJs and personally presented them. Do you remember that?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, I have one of those records hanging up in our recording studio here right now that was addressed to Mr. Rick Cheddar.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the owner and creator of Radio Memphis.
Well, and rightfully so. I mean, this thing started out, 21 years ago, mm-hmm. It was a fluke at radio, and it was, folks like you that, heard it, latched onto it, and just,
sure.
Spread it across America. And it became, I think in 95, that song, Christmas Eve 1224, became the number one requested song in America that year.
It did.
And every year after that. So, we owe everything to, you folks at radio and the folks in all the communities around the country that have embraced this thing.
I appreciate that so much. And it's so funny because I was telling Rick, I was like, yeah, we're finally going to get to catch up with him. And you've actually done a couple of interviews and stuff, with him when he was working. He was actually working, as far as corporate and working terrestrial radio. This is a station that we've created for the unsigned and indies and stuff. And one of the beautiful things, for me is that we get to talk to somebody who, has experiences, has advice, and remembers that time when nobody knew who he was. And, and there's that, because everybody looks at you and I just write off all of this incredible resume. And so everybody thinks you're an overnight success and everybody thinks that you've gotten all of this, it was all done, in a matter of a blink of an eye. And they don't understand probably what you had to go through, in order to get there.
Well, the funny thing about what you just said is that, at this point in my life, when I look over my left shoulder and look back, it seems like it went by in the blink of an eye.
Did it really?
Yeah, it really does. It's funny because, just a quick side note, last night we had a show in Tampa, Florida.
Uh-huh.
And, Facebook is an interesting thing because, sometimes, you kind of connect with, friends from, way back when. Sometimes it's a drag, but in this one situation worked out good because I had connected with a bunch of high school buddies that I haven't spoken to in literally 36 years.
Okay.
So I graduated in 1980. And we were kind of chatting back and forth over the last couple months. And I said, listen, why don't you get a couple of the old buddies together, and I'll get you tickets to the Tampa show.
Right.
And it was like, you know, five of my best friends, like these girls that I grew up with, and two or three other guys. Anyway, I haven't spoken to them, seen them, anything since the day we all graduated.
Oh, wow.
And when the lights came up and I was on stage, I looked out in the audience, and there they were in front of me.
Wow.
And you're talking about... Literally, it seemed like yesterday we were all kind of like trying to, you know, like cheat on the same geometry test together.
Now, at least you admitted it, man.
Oh, without a doubt. So, I mean, yeah, this is an overnight success that took about 10,000 overnights.
Okay, well, then there it is. And see, that's the perfect answer because, you know, every time I get to talk to somebody that's been doing this and really, you know, making a crack at it, they say the same thing.
And yeah, no, it's a lifetime. For you and I to have this conversation tonight, we'd have to rewind to probably 1976 when this whole mess started for me, you know?
And I'm okay. Well, see, because here's the thing. All right, we're in the middle of a metal show. I mean, mind you, this is an all-genre station. We do all kinds of cool stuff. And again, you know, we really promote the unsigned and indies and stuff. We have that opportunity, though, where we get to talk about anything and everything. And however long this takes, I'm willing to go back to 76 because I kind of want to know before you got your big breaks. And, you know, I wanted to know what you were doing.
Well, if you think about, you know, the late 60s and early 70s. Now, it's funny that you say, you know, you're an all-genre station because when I was a kid, there was no genre stations at all.
Wow.
It was WABC AM. That was it.
Wow.
Okay. So in my father's Impala, in that little speaker that was in the front dashboard, was my musical education back then. Now, you're talking about Motown.
Love it.
The Beatles, the Stones, Elvis, the Beach Boys, songs from Jesus Christ Superstar, South Pacific, The Sound of Music, you know, I mean, anything you could imagine was coming through. So the only two genres of music back then was good and bad.
So you had like one or the other and that was it.
That was it. You know, so I didn't know. And, you know, and as you were kind of, you know, reading part of my resume before, the reason why I've played with such a diverse amount of people is because I never painted myself into any particular corner. I just wanted to be a good guitar player.
Right.
You know, and then as you grew up in the 70s in the public school district, you know, you were either on the football team or you were handed a clarinet.
Wow.
You know, and I was too tiny to play on the football team, so I ended up playing trumpet. So I was exposed to all, you know, like Mozart and Chopin and Rachmaninoff and all those things in the schools, you know, being in the wind ensemble and the orchestra and the choir and all that stuff. So, you know, back then it was, you know, the music programs were really good, you know, and if you had a propensity for it, you can kind of excel at something. And I just latched onto that and never let go. And then forget about when bands like, you know, Zeppelin and Skinner and the Allman Brothers and Aerosmith and Mountain and Johnny Winter, all those bands hit. It was like, we were on.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. That's and crazy. There must have been 200 guitar players in the high school when I was going there.
That's you insane.
Know, everybody wanted to be a guitar player.
That's, well, I mean, because a guitar player is like, cool dude. He's the one that gets...
Yeah, they were almost as cool as singers, but a lot cooler than basketball players.
They were cooler than basketball players, and nobody wanted to date the bass player, right?
No, and I was on the wrestling team for about 30 minutes. I was like, I don't want to roll around on the mat with some dude.
No, I mean, but see, that's just the deal, though. I mean, so, you know, you start out, okay, and you're doing your thing as far as, you know, you're doing your thing in school. Now, there is something I read, and I want to say, because, I mean, I do a lot of stalking, because I try to find out as much as I can.
Of course.
And you know, and it's so funny because, you know, and mind you, I might flip-flop back and forth and stuff. I mean, I was trying to find out a lot of the stuff that you did, you know, before you really, you know, got known and before you really kind of jumped in and, you know, did the Sabotage and did Megadeth and, you know, all that stuff beforehand. And, you know, and I ran, and of course, I didn't realize the danger, you know, escapade mm-hmm. that happened through. And I thought, oh my God, I actually like rocked out and like, you know, sang, you know, and did my whole hairbrush, you know, in the mirror thing with you. So you and I have jammed together.
Awesome.
You just don't know me, but yeah, we've rocked out together and we were really good. Okay. Just so you know that.
All right, cool.
And I sat there and I came across something and it was about your junior high. Of like a band that's like, it's like one of your first bands that you started,
mm-hmm.
and I can't remember the name of it, you know. And it was like a real quick snippet. It didn't really say too much about it, but it was supposed to be kind of somewhat remarking and profound.
You know, you got me on that one. I remember being in a bunch of bands, like in junior high and high school. I'd have to really scratch my head for a minute to think of some of the names of them. Oh my God. Yeah. One of them, we were a Southern rock band. Wait, I was in seventh grade. That band was called Southbound.
Okay.
And then there was another band a little bit later on, and I think we called it the Jake Leslie Band.
That's the name.
The short story behind that is that I was such a Skynyrd fanatic, okay, and Leonard Skynyrd named their band after their high school gym teacher, whose name was Leonard Skinner.
My God, what is this theme? That's awesome.
No. This is what a music nerd I was, you know. Like, I knew everything about all these bands. Anyway, so now they came out of, I think, Gainesville, Florida, something like that, and you're talking about in the 60s when, like, long hair was not going to work down south.
Of course.
And this dude, Leonard Skinner, gave them a whole hard time, so they said, well, we're going to name our band after you and ruin your life, and that's what they did. Anyway,
nice.
So in junior high, I guess, we had a shop teacher named Myron Leslie, and he thought that Hot Tuna, the band, was actually a curse word.
Oh.
That's how twisted people were in the 70s.
Yeah.
And so we said, well, Skynyrd could do it, we could do it, so we named the band after him.
Now, how perfect is that? Okay, now that right there, that made sense. That made absolute sense. So I'm totally down with that. The other thing, you know, and mind you, like I said, I'm jumping around and stuff. And I know that, you know, I know that you spent your time, you know, you spent some time at Berkeley, which really, really, you know, describes your style, you know, to me. And it's one of those things that, you know, I do follow, you know, quite a bit. I did not realize that you actually did some stuff for Miami Vice.
Well,
I had
not Miami Vice, but for Philip Michael Thomas.
Well, there it is with him. And, you know, that right there for you, you know, was really what you kind of thought was your big break.
You know, it's weird because I just ran across that track and posted it on my Facebook page like a week or two ago.
Wow.
how coincidental, isn't it?
I promise I wasn't on your page, so I wouldn't even not know that.
Right.
See, that's
but, you know, it was one of those things. I was on the bus. It was myself, Jeff Scott Soto, who I'm sure you know quite well.
Yes.
And a couple of the other singers. We just cruised around. They're like, what is the first record you ever did? And I said, you know, I got to think. And then I remembered it was 1984, 1985, I think. Somewhere around there. Anyway, Don Johnson had a hit. There was a guy named Lance Quinn who had produced the first Bon Jovi record, who produced a song for Don Johnson. It was called, I think, Heartbeat or Heartbreak or something like that.
Yeah.
And he had, like, kind of a minor hit.
Yeah.
And so the other guy from Miami Vice, Philip Michael Thomas, wanted to do a song, too. And he was being produced by the dudes from Kool & the Gang.
Oh, wow.
So a friend of mine was an engineer on the session. He said, listen, they need a guitar player, like kind of a rock player, to come in and do something cool on this track. He said, you want to come in? I'm like, dude, it'd be my first record is on Atlantic Records. I'm in. It was awesome.
You did it.
So I went in, and it was like kind of like a dancey pop tune. It was what it was, but they really let me cut loose on it. I was so proud of myself. You know, I was like, wow, I went into like the Hit Factory in New York. I could almost afford the subway. It was awesome.
And you felt like you were really getting somewhere and that you were doing something?
And, you know, they were all like, hi. 5 minutes, like, dude, that's the best soul ever. I was like, well, I'm going to be on this major release. It's all going to begin. And that year, it was voted the top 5 worst records of all time by Billboard magazine.
See? I was not going to bring that up. Because
I'll talk about anything.
I read that, too, and I was like, because... Yeah, I remember that.
It was so
I remember
funny
it.
And to make matters worse, I never got paid for it. They welched.
Oh, so,
I mean, that was basically a really, like, broad stroke overview in, like, welcome to the music business, dude.
You know, well, okay, so you got it all in one shot.
Got it every which way. And, you know, and I didn't mind because, again, I had done it. I met a bunch of people in the studio. And, you know, at the end of the day, whether the song was good or it was bad, it didn't matter. But, you know, I played, and a lot of people said, hey, that was pretty awesome. And all of a sudden, word started spreading around New York City, and, you know, the phone started to ring a little bit.
Well, saying that's exactly what that was. It was more of a door opener than anything else.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, you do that 1,000 times in your career, and then finally the one big door will open up for you. But, you know, yeah, I always remained positive about it because I didn't care. I just wanted to play guitar. I knew if I stunk or if I was good, you know.
Okay.
And then, you know, I wasn't worried about critical acclaim or anything like that. I just wanted to play, and I wanted the people to hear about me, and I just wanted to work.
And that was the deal. And that was what you wanted to do. This is what you've always wanted to do. So you were going to do whatever it took.
Yeah, I didn't care if I made any money or didn't make any money, but come hell or high water, I was just going to play guitar. That's all I was going to do.
That's it. So you wound up. And the cool thing about you, I mean, all right, So in the middle of all of this, let's backtrack for a second, because, you know, you decide to go to school. You decide to go to Berkeley. Mm-hmm. You know, ultimate choice, driven choice, suggested choice, no choice. I mean, how was that?
All of the above, I think. Oh, I think all of the above. I was in a band on Long Island. The guitar player in this band had left to go away to college. He went to Berkeley. So they had the ad out in the local music paper.
Okay.
And I answered the ad, and I went and joined auditioned for this band. They hired me.
Sure.
I was like, oh, man, awesome, because our guitar player just left, and he went to Berkeley up in Boston. I'm like, oh, cool, whatever. I was like, you know, and I must have been 19 at the time. And we're playing, and we're having a great time. And he goes, listen, our old guitar player is going to come back and visit for Christmas holiday. You want to say hello? I'm like, yeah, sure, I'd love to. So this dude walks in, and it's Steve Vai.
Oh, man.
Yeah, which, wow. You know, that happens all the time in your life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay, and for those of you who have tuned in, we're actually talking to the most awesome Al Petrelli, but he's talking about a moment in his world where it went upside down. Continue.
Yeah, and you know what was weird? It didn't go upside down because he was such a great dude.
How
he walked in, he's like, oh my God, dude, I love your playing. And I was like, oh, thank you so much. And then he grabbed the guitar and we started playing. I'm like, and he was on a different level even back then.
Wow.
But, you know, we became buddies. I mean, he was just like a good Italian guy from Long Island.
Love it.
And he was a couple years older than me, and he had left Long Island. He went to this, like, kind of faraway place, this mystical place called Berkeley School up in Boston. And as we were chatting over the years, he goes, listen, not for nothing, but you should probably get off Long Island and come up here. It's a really good place. Now, he had just gotten a job with Frank Zappa.
Oh, okay.
So he was starting to really take off, and people were starting to pay attention to him. So the thing is that when somebody in a position that I really want to be in starts to speak, I stop talking and I pay attention to what they're doing, because they're obviously doing something right if I want to follow in their footsteps.
Perfect.
So a couple years later, I said, well, I'm going to go to Berkeley. You know, Steve went and worked for him. I might as well go there, you know.
Sure.
And when I was up in school there, I became best friends with a couple people. We started a band together. And these people, one of the guys was a keyboard player named Derek Sherinian.
Yes.
Who ended up being with me and Alice Cooper years ago, and then went on to play with the Dream Theater and 100 other bands over the years.
Of course.
Will Calhoun was the drummer in our band at school. He went on to form that band Living Color.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? All of us, like, all this, you have to understand, like, the circles and stuff that we've been kind of hanging out with and talking to, and people that we've reached out to here just in a couple weeks. Our world here is like everything. It's amazing how everybody connects.
And everything's connected.
And the world is kind of small.
It really is. And you're talking about a very incestuous, you know, business. I mean, the music business, if you, especially if you're fast-forwarding, like, you know, 35 or 40 years later, you know, there's certain people that are in your life for a reason, and, like, you go all those years back, and you have this little, like, ensemble band in some classroom,
right.
And it's me, Will, and Derek, and I forgot the bass player's name off the top of my head, but you're talking about, you know, three of those four people went on to do pretty good for themselves. I mean, that's right. The kind of institution that Berkeley was. I only lasted there, like, maybe two semesters, because I'd had enough. You know,
wow.
I wasn't into the formal education side, and I met some great people from all over the world, and
okay.
I realized how terrible I really was, and I needed to go home and practice, because there's some monsters out there.
You really?
Oh, my God. When you're like the hotshot on Long Island, and then you go to like a place like Berkeley, and you realize that there's 1,200 guitar players that enrolled for the first semester, you know, it's not going to go that well for most people.
So you showed up, and you decided that you sucked, and you left.
No, I just sucked less than everybody up there.
That's wrong.
No, there was some great players there, but I just realized, I was like, you know what? I need to go home and focus on one thing, because you can get lost up there. And I didn't want to go like 4 years and graduate and then be completely confused, you know?
Okay.
I said, I'd rather go back to New York City. With knowledge I've gained here, I want to go back and cut my teeth more and really apply everything that I've learned. Sometimes too much knowledge becomes a hindrance.
That's so strange. I've heard that before, believe it or not.
Yeah, especially musically. If you learn too much and you get too geeky, you stop being a player and you start being like a math nerd.
How do you get too geeky?
Spend that much time around that many talented people and you'll forget that, like, you know, there's a music, you know, you're supposed, if you want to be a session player, you're not going to repeat, like, all the mathematics in the studio.
Right.
You know, you want to go down there and create parts and create music and like, be the person who's on these records who's doing, like, cool stuff. You
okay.
know, I didn't want to become too much of, like, a virtuoso math nerd.
Ah.
If that makes any sense.
That does make sense, you know, and it's, I think you're, like, the first person, though, that's ever put it in this context. You know, it's almost like, pull back. You know,
just pull back. Yeah, because when I first got home, I started playing with Michael Bolton, and I'd play, and he'd look at me and goes, dude, what are all those notes you're doing? That's got nothing to do with my songs. And I'm like, huh?
What do you mean? So he tried to tell, he wanted you to keep it a little more simple for him.
Not only simple, but, you know, musically appropriate, I guess is the only way I could put it. You know, as a guitar player, my job is to create soundtracks for singers, to create underscoring for, you know, people's songs and their lyrics and their vocals, you know?
Sure.
I didn't want to be, I wanted to be Steve Lukather. That's who I aspire to, or Jeff
comes.
Beck.
Okay, here it comes.
You know, Neil Sean, like those kind of guys. That's who I really want to be.
Good enough.
So if you know too much and you play too much, you're getting in the way of the singer and you're getting in the way of the song, then you're not going to work that much in New York City, especially in New York when you're talking about doing records and jingles and sessions and stuff like that.
Wow. See, that makes perfect sense now.
That's what I really always wanted to do. And regardless of what style it was, I just wanted to be musically respectful to whatever I was doing at the time.
Well, and you know, and it's funny because when you say that, you know, Al, looking at some of the people that you worked with, I mean, on the, you know, we're talking on the realms of, okay, Sabotage, you know, Megadeth, and then you're jumping over and you've got Exposé, you've got Kathy Tricoli, you got Michael Bolton and stuff. I mean, you were...
Yeah, Celine Dion and Taylor Dane and, you know, bunch of other people.
All right, you know, of course, you know, the Taylor Dane one, to me, was obvious only because of the relationship as far as with Twisted Sister. I mean, and I figured that, totally figured that one out.
Well, and Taylor grew up on Long Island. I mean, her and I went to college together at Nassau Community for Sylvester, you know, she was just like a great barroom rock and roll singer. Her favorite singer ever was Paul Rogers.
Ah.
You know, and then when she started doing this dance thing, she kind of found her niche and it clicked. So, you know, to work on her records or a Celine Dion record, or at the same time doing a Dee Snider record. Listen, the catch is that if you think that there's only 12 notes in music, okay, and it's the combinations of those notes that make it infinite. You know, there's a finite amount of ingredients with an infinite amount of combinations. I never wanted to just be stuck in one style. I enjoy playing all styles of music.
Perfect.
And all I had to do was learn to be musically mature enough to play in any one of those situations. And that's what I did.
And that's what you did. So basically, so from what I understand and what I'm hearing, is that all of these groups and all of these people and stuff, I mean, were somewhat personal relationships, whether you guys went to school together, you hung out together, you know, you lived down the street from each other, you know, whatever.
That's how it started, yeah.
So, you know, being in the right place at the right time and the right moment, and not, I mean, it's not like you knew where any of these people were going to be or what they were going to do at the time you ran into them.
No, I think that in this case, you know, being an aspiring musician and trying to cut your teeth would be no different than going to, like, pre-law school. You know, I mean, basically, if you strip away the title or the avenue that you're pursuing, at the end of the day, it's just about being a decent human being and conducting yourself with decorum and class and etiquette. You know, I mean, everybody likes to hang out with people that they like. People like to recommend people for jobs that they know that they're going to be, you know, okay.
Yes, yes, and that you're going to be true to your word and that you're going to take care of business. And
yeah, you're going to do your job, you're going to be polite, you're going to be pleasant. I mean, I do a lot of lecturing at colleges, and, you know, everything that I talk about has nothing to do with the mechanics of music. It's all about, listen, if you want to get a job, this is what you should not do.
Perfect.
You know? Like, oh, I should say, if you want to lose a job, this, you know,
if you want,
you know, I've made plenty of mistakes, but, you know, everything, if you strip away all the nonsense of what, you know, the music industry is, at the end of the day, walking into a room is easy. When you leave the room, what those people say about you is what's paramount at that point.
Did at any point, and I'm just curious, you know, all of these cool things are happening, all these cool projects are happening, you're jumping in and you're working on albums and stuff, and all of this, you know, is pretty much, you know, as far as, you know, early on, you know, we're talking 80s, you know, 80s going into, you know, the early 90s, you know, when all of this really rocks, and, you know, at any point did you really feel like, okay, oh my God, my career is taking off, oh my God, or did you just feel like, this is just what I do?
I think I got caught up in it for a couple minutes, probably in 88 or 89.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like got brought back to reality real quick.
Oh, okay.
You know, for no apparent reason, nothing crazy, just like you get caught up with it and all of a sudden, well, the phone stops ringing for a month or two and it's just like, okay, this could all magically disappear tomorrow. So let's remember where we came from. Let's keep working hard and let's keep our eye on what the big picture is, which I had no idea what the big picture was, but I was working towards something. I just wasn't certain what that was yet.
See, I need for somebody to tell me what the big picture is because I want to know. I don't know what it is either.
I don't know. I think to be part of something that... like I had made, I had done really well for myself, and I had a really good run of it career-wise, working for a lot of people.
Sure.
I wasn't satisfied because I wanted to create something. I wanted to be part of the creation of something that was going to be part mine, like one of my children.
Okay.
So everything up until that point was kind of like, you know, I either worked for the boss. It was, you know, if it was Dee's band, it was Dave's band and Megadeth.
Right.
You know, every other artist, and I have no problem with that. That was what my job was at the time. I was not satisfied until I got to sit down and help create something. And that did not occur until 1995 when I actually got to sit down finally after knowing Paul O'Neill for 10 years to sit in his apartment in New York City. And he looked at me and goes, I have this idea I want you to help me with.
Okay.
And we just started sitting at the kitchen table writing ideas. And that was like when one of your children is born or conceived.
Wow.
You know, and that was the beginnings of what the Trans-Siberian Orchestra has become.
Right. Well, and of course, you know, and a lot of people don't realize, you know, that ultimately, you know, Sabotage is what translates, you know, into that.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And so, you know, and of course, you know, us, you know, and let me kind of, you know, give, you know, props up and shout back out, you know, because I'm in the middle of a metal show, too. You know, metalheads are like, oh, my God, you're talking to Al Petrelli. Yes, you know, Sabotage. And I'm like, remember where Sabotage went. You remember mm-hmm. what it is now.
Yeah.
You know, and so when you guys sit down, I mean, ultimately, you know, it's in one form, but then when you guys get together and sit down, you know, was it, we're going to do this Christmas thing, we're going to do this, I mean, or was it, it had to be just something magical, special, and it had to be X components? I mean, how do you sit down at a table and throw all your marbles in the middle, and how do you go? I mean, what was thought?
Excuse me. What happened was, we recorded the Dead Winter Dead record. Mm. That's when Paul had first called me.
Okay.
And he said he had something really special that he was working on. He wanted me to come in and see if I could at least help bring it to life a little bit.
Right.
And he put up the faders on Christmas Eve, Sarajevo, 12/24. And I said, "You're playing, you know, Carol of the Bells, really?"
Yeah.
And I looked at him. I go, "What's this all about?" And he explained to me that it was a song that's part of the soundtrack about the war in Bosnia.
Right.
And he said it's really not a Christmas song, but it's a soundtrack that is to describe Christmas when this one cellist, which is a true story, back in the war, was playing you know, Christmas music and classical music in the town square in protest of the bombings that was going on.
I see.
So I looked at him and I said, and kind of the hair on my arm stood up, I said, well, you know what, I was in that town square because I was Alice Cooper's musical director in 89.
Wow.
And I said, we played Zagreb and Belgrade in Yugoslavia before the war. I said, every place that you're talking about in the story of yours, Dead Winter Dead, I've been to. You know, the Colosseums that we had played in were reduced to rubble during the fighting. A lot of the people that I became friends with over there were killed during the war.
Oh, wow.
So we kind of both looked at each other. I said, do me a favor, just press record right now. And as he pressed record, I started playing guitar in it, and the song kind of came to life.
Wow.
And then, you know, I thought that was the end of the relationship because, you know, how many heavy metal versions of a Christmas song could you possibly have in 1995 that were going to be successful?
How many could you?
You know what I mean? None.
I'm just asking. I figured there was an answer.
It became the number one requested song in America that winter. And then the following year, he said, listen, we're onto a hit. Sabotage sold hundreds of thousands of records, but he goes, I got to write an entire story around this one song. We're going to call it a different band. It's going to be an offshoot project. I said, all right, cool. And that's when we started writing Christmas Eve and other stories, you know, and just innocently throwing musical ideas on the kitchen table, literally.
Wow.
Because we had no idea what this was going to become. We were just going to chase another piece of art. That was the one thing Paul taught me. Don't worry about commercial success. Don't worry about money. Worry about making great art, and maybe, if we're lucky, it'll catch on.
See, that's the advice. That's it. That's the little grains and pieces that I look for that I want. Because, you know, one of the things that we do at Radio Memphis and stuff, you know, we're always, we have a lot of musicians that tune in. We have a lot of, you know, artists and bands and stuff, you know, that tune in and get a lot of support, you know, from the station and stuff. And so when they get to hear that, that right there makes sense. But that's, you know, that comes from a heart that is true and blue and forcefully believes, you know, in all of that. Now you wind up, you know, giving birth to your first child, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of all of this shows up Megadeth.
Yeah.
And one of the things about what you did was is that you simultaneously did them both at the same time.
Yeah, well, that was kind of easy. I mean, in theory, it was easy because what happened was Jimmy DeGrasso, who was playing drums with Megadeth at the time, he and I had known each other for years, back to the old club days. Marty Friedman was talking about leaving the band.
Okay.
and they were in the middle of a tour, and obviously, you know, if he left the band whenever, you know, that was going to be the end of the tour, and they couldn't afford to do that. So he said, listen, we need somebody just to fill in until we could find a permanent replacement. I was like, all right, you know, I flew out there to meet with Dave and Dave Elfson. I think I went to Vegas, and they said, listen, Marty's kind of on the fence. We're not sure when he's going to bail, but could you just, like, learn this stuff and be at the ready to jump in at any moment? Just get us through the American leg of the tour. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely, dude. All right, no worries. And I learned the stuff, and, you know, talk about going to school, you know. Working for Mustaine, that is going to boot camp.
That is going to severe boot camp.
Yeah, I mean, he's so brilliant at what he does that it was a whole... I mean, I learned so much in that time that I spent with him. It was incredible as a guitar player.
Wow.
So anyway, the short version of the long story is that, you know, I filled in for a couple weeks after Marty left, and then they had a tour over, and I think he wanted to go to Korea, or, you know, he wanted to hit, you know... that whole part of the Asian continent.
Sure.
I was like, yeah, I'll fill in, you know, you guys got a permanent replacement yet? He's like, nah, we're looking at a couple people. But he goes, just, could you just keep working with us? And that lasted, I think, 22 months.
Okay, wow.
You know,
that's a, like, that's a serious.
Yeah, I was the most permanent short-term replacement in the history of that band.
He lasted longer than several of the other guys.
Yeah, no kid, we did like 3 records, a live DVD.
But, you know, just hanging out, you know.
Yeah, but it's only temporary, you know, just until we find somebody good.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Hey, but listen, can we go back? So, for some of your listeners, you just, the previous conversation we were having about chasing the art, if you think about it, now you've been in radio a while.
Yes.
All the bands that come out and, like, kind of grabbed you by the soul were the bands that were completely different than the norm that you were playing at the time.
Yes.
Over the course of history, right?
Sure. Absolutely.
Zeppelin, Guns N' Roses, whoever it was, the Stones, the Beatles, anybody who came out and really, like, got your attention was somebody who was doing absolutely the opposite, the polar opposite of what was popular at the time.
And what everybody expected and what everybody wanted, you know, expected you to, you know, be a part of. And, yeah,
exactly.
You're right. You're
That's
right.
Why when TSO hit with that first song, you know, albeit under the name Sabotage at TSO, when 1224 hit the radio in every format, nobody had ever heard anything like that before.
No, that was, and it was crazy.
It was, yeah, it was kind of crazy.
It was absolutely crazy, and it was totally amazing. And, you know, and again, you know, for you, you know, one of the special things that you get to do is, you know, not only are you, you know, you get to play in it, but you obviously, you know, you're one of the creators, you know, and you're the musical director. And so for you, you know, for you, there's a lot of people as far as in the group and stuff that look to you for the guidance and look for you for the creative, you know, inspirations, you know, and things like that. And so, you know, ultimately you did, you know, you did adopt a bunch of kids, you
yeah,
know,
pretty much,
you know, with instruments and voices and things like that, you know, and so is this your happy place?
Musically, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm real happy with where I've landed after 54 years on this planet.
Wow.
I mean, I absolutely, my personal life is so blessed. And my professional life, I mean, working with Paul O'Neill for what's going on 21 years now. I mean, like you had said earlier, it's like watching one of my children grow up.
Wow.
I mean, and the thing is that, like anything else, you go through infancy and the baby being a toddler and young adulthood, and adolescence was a pain in the neck with this band.
I bet. And that's, you know, and there was a lot of growing pains. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, like I said, because of, you know, shot out of the rocket, shot out of the cannon, and it was like, oh, well, mm-hmm. Shoot. Okay, we've made an impact. Now we have.
Yeah, and we were inventing it on the fly. I mean, you know.
Right. And now we have to follow through.
And it's got to be better every year. But over the last, I don't know, however many years it's been, we've been touring for 16 years, you know, nonstop.
Yes.
We've gotten the greatest people, the greatest talent on the stage and underneath the stage ever, to the point where my job is so simple. You know, I just got to show up and start them and stop them. You know, I mean, the greatest singers in the world. I got, in my opinion, the greatest band ever.
Wow.
I mean, we've been playing together 16 years in a row, you know, at the top of the food chain. I mean, the crew, the department heads from the crew come from all over the planet. I mean, the biggest acts ever.
That's crazy.
You know? So when you look at this production, which has 18 tractor trailers and 10 buses, I think we sold like 950,000 tickets this year in 6 weeks.
That is so crazy.
Wow.
You know, and I look at it, and I'm just, it's, again, it's not pounding my chest, it's not saying, hey, look at what we've done, but it's like, look at what one of my children has accomplished. It's exceeded all my expectations, it's grown up to be something that I'm so proud of, and more importantly, not even on a musical level anymore, but the fact that everybody comes up to me now, and says, you know, dude, it's not the holidays until you guys roll through town or I play your music or your guitar is in my living room from Thanksgiving until New Year's.
Same.
You know, no musician dreams this up.
That's a crazy thing. That's a crazy feeling. And for somebody like you, I think, Al, that for the background that you have, you know, in all the different styles, all the different groups, all the different people, you know, all the different personalities and stuff that you worked with was ultimately what prepared you for that moment.
I think all of them. I think everything that I've done, you know, if I'm looking back over my shoulder over a very long period of time, obviously unbeknownst to me at the time, but working from learning how to read scores in junior high and high school, you know, in the bands in the music department like we spoke about.
Of course.
From being in every bar band on Long Island, you know, from 1976 to like 1981, you know, cutting your teeth, learning how to play and learning how to improvise, and studying with, you know, my teachers with John Schofield and Leslie West.
Oh, wow.
You know, to having Steve Vai as a mentor and telling me, listen, dude, no matter what, make sure you can always read and sight read and all the things that people don't pay attention to musically, make sure that you're really proficient at those things because you never know when they're going to come in handy. Just working with Alice Cooper, I mean, my first introduction to theatrical presentations of rock songs, you know.
He's got it.
Who would have thunk that here I am, I'm in Trans-Siberian Orchestra, and we're basically putting on like a heavy metal Broadway show every night.
Yeah, and he'd be so proud.
and he is. I ran into Alice a couple years ago. He's like, dude, I cannot believe what you accomplished. I'm so proud of you. I was like, listen, you taught me a lot of this, you know. Even Dave Mustaine, Dee Snider, every one of them has taught me something that I brought to the table to help make TSO what it is. You know,
wow.
One of the greatest lessons Mustaine ever told me, or one of the greatest things he ever said to me, was no matter what, stay teachable. You know, and Paul O'Neill reiterated the same thing. You know, if you just keep chasing art, you know, you'll never be bored because you can never, you know, once art ceases to change or grow, then it's dead.
There it is.
You know, so every day I'm on stage with eight of the greatest singers in the world with a great band. I have to speak the language fluently to my eight-piece string section.
Wow.
You know, and I just get up there. I get to kind of tap into every part of, you know, musicality that there is on a daily basis in a different room, you know. And it's the greatest, greatest job ever.
That's insane. Now, how is it, and for those of you that have tuned in, you are talking to the most wonderful Al Pacelli. How is it that you're able to balance and make all of this fantastic work? Because here's the thing. You've got this rigorous tour, okay, and it's all through the holidays and stuff like that, which is a rough time in and of itself. But a lot of people don't understand that there's a lot of rehearsals, there's a lot of, you know, performances and practices and stuff like that leading up to this. And the fact that you juggle, you know, a wonderful home life, including having five kids.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it?
Doing it poorly for so many years has taught me to finally do it correctly.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Are the kids musical?
My three older sons, the middle one, Jamie, is an incredible bass player who's actually the musical director for this band on Atlantic, this artist named Max Frost.
Oh, okay.
You know, and he's constantly touring, constantly working, constantly writing. You know, he's like a miniature version of me, but he's so much better than I was at his age.
You're a proud
my
dad.
My other two sons, one is a sniper in the Special Forces.
Oh, wow.
And the other one is an engineer on a nuclear sub out of Pearl Harbor.
Well, my goodness, you have like, you've got like super genes.
Yeah. Those three boys are just incredible. My two daughters, Olivia's 5 years old. She's a rock star diva already.
Okay. Beware. Beware.
She's a huge, she loves music. I know every One Direction song by name, by lyric now.
And you sing it.
Can you sing it?
And I'm singing them along all the time. With her. It's awesome.
You have to sing it with her too, don't you?
Without a doubt. And she tells me that I'm singing it the wrong way.
Of course you are.
And listen, you know, she plays piano a little bit. She sings a little bit. She dances a little bit. She's growing up in this world. She doesn't know that everybody's daddy isn't me. You know what I mean? Like she comes to the shows and she's got her laminate and she's backstage and you know she hangs out with all the girls. I mean, she doesn't know anything different.
Right.
And Layla is 8 months old, so she just went to her first show. My wife brought the girls down to Atlanta last week.
Aww.
Yeah, so I got to stand on the stage, look in the audience, and see these two little peanuts in there, just looking back up, going, why is he wearing eyeliner and why is he on stage?
Well, and here's the thing, though. What are you going to do, though, when they want that life?
encourage anything they want, you know.
They're girls, though. The boys are, this is like, you have to understand something. You know, my father, you know, he's born and raised from the Bronx, okay? I was actually born in New York, too, but I spent most of my time down here. And, you know, and listening to dads, you know, especially Yankees, dads and their daughters, and it's, you know, you look at them and you go, yeah, I already know what all of this is about. You sure?
Mm-hmm.
You sure? I've done this. You sure?
Yeah, well,
you
know, let me put it to you this way. My wife comes from the Bronx.
Ah, so they're fine.
She grew up on Benson Street.
Yeah.
So there's nothing that these two little girls can pull over my wife's eyes or past me that we ain't done before.
No, okay, yeah. So as long as they're taken care of.
You know, I think that, you know, all the cliches about, you know, like daddy and his daughters and all that stuff, all right, whatever, you know, I'm sure, you know, I'll have to deal with part of that, but I think that we have such an incredible home life, and even the work life, like, you know, like when I go to work, you know, their uncle is Paul O'Neill and John Oliva. You know, that's who their uncles are. That's, you know, they come to work and they're surrounded by, you know, people who've been working together our whole lives. We've created this thing, so they're part of this bigger family. Nothing bad's ever going to happen to any of these kids.
Wow. Yeah. That's the way it's supposed to be.
And besides, their mother carries a gun.
Okay, well, there it is. Now the truth comes out. All of that beforehand sounded amazing, but the truth is, mama's got a gun. Got it.
Yeah, she don't need a gun. She's terrifying enough as it is. But,
yeah.
If these little girls grow up to be anything like the woman their mom is, then I win hands down.
No, see, that's the way it's supposed to be. That's the way it's supposed to be. And but the thing about it is that, you know, how awesome is it that you have such a wonderful family? You know, you've got a huge family, you know, of you know, wonderful children that are obviously doing some amazing things. You know, you're doing a really cool thing watching your other baby, you know, grow and make other families happy, especially during the holiday seasons and stuff like that. You know, but you just got done telling us, you know, the one thing that you've always learned is that you have to continue to be teachable, you have to continue to grow and stuff, so you still have to have goals. And what are your goals now? You've done so much. What would your goals now be?
Just being better, you know, next year being a little bit better than I was the previous year.
Yeah.
TSO, like, you know, my sixth child, each one of these kids growing up another year and becoming better at what they are. You know, and I'll always keep a stranglehold on their safety and their well-being. You know, I have a moment in the tour this year where, like, the hydraulic lift in the front, I get lifted up pretty high up in the air, about 25 feet in the air.
Oh, wow.
And I'm playing Christmas Eve 12:24, and I have, like, I'm above the highest seat in the arena, you know, and I just sit there and I look out, and I can't help but smile, because I remember the day I recorded the notes to that song. And Paul and I looked at each other and said, wow, you know, this is really cool. And 21 years later, I'm playing this song sitting on top, literally atop the arena, looking out in front of 13,000 to 14,000 people who are all standing up with their fists in the air. You know, you know what? I got to top this next year. So get me off this riser, because I want to go home and figure out how to make it better. Because every year it's gotten bigger and every year it's gotten better. You know, every year one of my kids is a year older and a little bit better and a little bit smarter. That's my goal until I close my eyes for the last time, is just to, you know, to keep a watchful eye over all these things that I love so dearly.
Wow. That's perfect. Now, I was going to say is, you guys, as a family, there was something I did read, is that you've got a real kind of cool tradition for the Christmas holidays that you always do on Christmas or Christmas Eve.
With the band or with my family?
With your family.
Well, I mean, back in the day, my family was really twisted. We used to watch The Godfather together.
Well, and that
on
was
Christmas.
That's kind of the thing I was kind of going towards. But, you know,
yeah, that's a little like weird, but that's what we did. Nothing says Merry Christmas like a horse's head in your bed.
And just, you know, was it because it was the Italian reference thing? You know, is that,
you know, I don't know what it was, because, you know, Italians are weird. Like, no matter what, you have like big ziti for dinner. If it's 4th of July, you bring the big ziti outside. That's your barbecue for Christmas. You know, we didn't have like ham and turkey. We had big ziti, and The Godfather was playing every Christmas morning. I was like, oh, this is really dark. Okay, whatever.
But then you had to
with
watch
my
it.
Family. Now we celebrate Christmas whenever it is that I come home. And my wife is so amazing. She's like, look, you know, the biblical religious holiday is the day that it is. She goes, but until you come home with your family, we're not celebrating a thing.
That's perfect. You know? That's the way.
So whatever day that is, you know, the day I get home, you know, that becomes Christmas Eve, and you know, we'll kind of stay up late, and we'll wrap presents, we'll put them under the tree, and it could be January 2nd, it could be January 8th, but whatever day, that next morning, we all wake up, that's Christmas for the Petrelli family.
That's perfect. Okay, now, is there baked ziti involved on that day?
My wife's over. She doesn't want any more baked ziti. She's done.
get your baked ziti while you're on the road.
So now we're ham and turkey in it and stuff.
I'm not sure what we'll do. We'll kind of figure out the menu as we get a little bit closer. She's going to come out and spend New Year's Eve with me. We have the show in Seattle.
Yes.
And that's our kind of like New Year's weekend, and then we'll fly home and we'll get Christmas going, and I'm sure she'll decide what we're going to cook and all those kind of things. I can't wait to discuss that. That's what's really exciting to me, is to put my guitar down and say, okay, honey, what are we cooking for Christmas dinner?
That's it. I'm saying that's the way it's supposed to be. Well, you have an amazing world. You have an amazing life.
It took a long time to get here, and there was a lot of mistakes and a lot of, you know, not so pleasant things that occurred, but you know, for the past 4 or 5 years now, it's absolutely perfect.
Would you tell everybody, you know, and especially those that listen that want to learn? What was your biggest heartbreak? Your biggest heartbreak?
Oh God.
There's always got to be that one.
I think my best friend Charlie Yao died a couple years ago.
Okay.
He was the guy, we were the best friends for 20 years. He was a lieutenant commander in the United States Coast Guard. We were absolutely polar opposites as people, but we just, you know, fell in love with each other from the moment, you know, we couldn't agree on anything. I think that's what we loved about each other.
Perfect.
We spent every family vacation together. He'd come to see 40 TSO shows a year. He was with me in Megadeth. He'd come to those shows. We were just absolutely the most inseparable brothers you could imagine. He unfortunately ended up, I think, a couple years ago with pancreatic cancer, and he died within months of his diagnosis.
Wow. I am so sorry to hear that.
And that's just, you know, I mean, that's one of those things that, you know, there's no negotiating with that. You know, once somebody's that sick and they have to go, I don't care how hard you stomp your feet or you whinge or cry or throw a hissy fit, he ain't going to change it, you know? And one of the last things he said to me is just like, just keep being you, just keep living every day, you know?
And that's what you
that's
remember.
Why, like, I will not let a day go past that I haven't lived everything to its fullest.
Perfect. That's the other answer that we're always looking for when it's something like
that. Yeah, within reason. I mean, you got to be responsible. I mean, you know, I have people that I'm responsible for, taking care of my wife, my children. But I'm not going to waste a second of time any day on anything trivial or trite. I'm not going to get caught up in anything stupid. And I want to make sure that I've lived the fullest day. I've done the best job that I could. You know, I've been the best father, the best husband that I could be. You know?
That's
and then this way, if like for some reason like tomorrow doesn't show up, all right, I didn't waste a minute.
And not a single one when it all comes to that.
Nope.
At all.
No, you never take anything for granted. My wife, my children, my band, my relationship with Paul O'Neill. You know, he's like the brother that I never had, you know. Every day I want to make sure that he's proud of what we've done. He's proud of the job that I've done for him. The 13,000 people in that audience just said that was the best show they ever seen. I think if you ask me what would be my next biggest heartbreak,
yeah,
is if anybody ever walked out of that arena saying, it was better last year. You know,
yeah.
So though I don't want to ever feel that pain again, it's inevitable that, you know, you're going to get your heart broken and something bad's going to happen. But when it's in my control, that will never happen. I'll make sure that, you know, the TSO legacy stays intact forever.
That's perfect.
Very nice. Al, as a guitar nerd myself, I need to ask you something.
Uh-huh.
He's like, something. I want to ask him something.
let me get there in my own time. I remember hearing Dead Winter Dead for the first time when I was a sophomore at Berkeley. And as much as I was blown away by the album and the overall concept of it, it was your guitar tone on This Is the Time.
And oh my God, thank you.
I still have been, that's my lead tone that I've been chasing for 20 years almost now. I got to ask, what gear did you use to get that?
Here he comes.
Dude, that was my Black Les Paul and a Marshall head.
Really?
That's simple. And it was just me trying to beat Neil Sean so bad.
It was close, you know? But that tone.
You know, I mean, listen. I've tried to emulate great guitar players, especially playing ballads. You know, like that's my favorite thing to try to do.
Love it.
And Gary Moore and Neil Sean and Jeff Beck and Brian May, you know, and you know, Leslie West taught me a long, long time ago. He said, kid, if you get a good note, hang on to it.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, that was one of the things that did get Paul's attention about my guitar playing was, you know, being able to be a very lyrical guitar player.
Yeah, this
you know,
is
like
the time
what we talked
still.
About earlier about, you know, musical, being appropriate musically in each song.
Sure.
You know, like when you listen to Zach Stevens sing that song, you know, you have to really, like, dig deep to say something more than he said, you know, as a singer, because he was magnificent on that record.
Yeah, that whole album. I mean, I remember sitting in my dorm on Boylston Street and listening over and over again to that album, just trying to figure out why your guitar tone was the way it was for that song in particular and for the rest of the album as well. You know, just...
God, I mean, Dave Whitman, who was engineering that record, I mean, he started out and he did, like, the first couple Kiss albums. He did Houses of the Holy for Zeppelin. He did Rebel Yell with Billy Idol. He'd been in the studio with some amazing guitar players. So, you know, basically having his technique, miking the amp and all that stuff, putting it to tape. But I think at that point in my life, I was really angry as a person, too.
Damn.
You know, so when you grab a guitar and you put just a little extra stink into it, that's how the note sounds.
You can tell there's a lot of emotion in your
brain. Yeah, I wasn't a happy person in 1995.
Well, but apparently that's what made something happen, though, you know?
Well, yeah, it worked for what it needed to do, you know? I mean, and then what happens is when you're unhappy and then you become happy, the trick is to always keep that unhappiness put away somewhere so you can call upon it when you need to.
Sure.
Yeah? So what do you do when you call upon it? I mean, what are you like, you know, have a meeting in your mind about it?
No, it's become, like, kind of natural. I like to fight.
Oh, okay.
I train with a lot of professional fighters, like almost every day, like UFC fighters and
I love it.
Pro boxers.
I do Muay Thai kickboxing.
Oh, you do?
I do.
Oh, awesome. First of all, it's the greatest workout ever. So
yes.
Now, if you think about it, now you'll understand what I'm saying. That, you know, like, you know, I'm in a really, really good mood all day, and then, like, I kind of step into the ring or the cage or whatever, mm-hmm. and I put my wraps and my gloves on, and mm-hmm. I'm moving around with one of my coaches, and he'll just punch me in the face, and then I'll be in a bad mood.
And that's all it takes.
So... same thing, like if I'm recording, I just have to remind myself of something not so pleasant, and I can go there at will, and then I can leave it there at will. That's the trick, is leaving it behind. Because, like, when I'm done sparring with one of my coaches, you know, at the end of getting blasted in the mouth a bunch of times or choked in, like, some jiu-jitsu hellishness,
sure.
When they call time, I look at them, and, we high-five, and we hug, and we go out and have a beer afterwards, you know?
And
I mean,
done.
It's just a moment of discipline that needs to be executed. You don't take it anywhere else with you, and that's what I've had to learn between 1995 and 2016, is you don't drag that negativity with you. You just tap into it when you need it.
You are an emotionally challenged,
twisted individual.
You are, and you have to be, man. And, you know, and of course, you know, God love your wife, man. She's probably one of the coolest, most amazing women on the planet.
On the planet.
Period. You know?
No, she really is. She's incredible.
You know?
Because she doesn't care about any of this, you know? She just cares about the important things. She wants to be happy. She wants somebody who loves them. She wants to love somebody. She wants, you know, a great dad for the children. You know, and the fact that, you know, she gets to come to, you know, these shows, she doesn't care about the show. She loves the fact that it's an entertaining show and that the girls enjoy. She's not taken back by all this nonsense.
That's perfect.
Yeah, it really is. She keeps me really grounded all the time because she threatens to punch me and cause violent physical harm.
Oh,
at all
so
times.
That's why you train.
Oh, God, yeah. I'm only afraid of her. My coaches are walking the park with my wife.
I'm all about it, man. Like I said, the whole training process and everything else. Now, just out of curiosity, so, you know, you do you still teach? Do you still have, you know, do you still give lessons and things like that?
You know, I haven't in a while. I do a lot of lectures at colleges, like we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
A lot of speaking engagements, but I'm actually going to start teaching it again in the not so distant future because I really want. I miss doing that. I really enjoy doing that, and I haven't done it for years.
Okay.
And every so often, I'll sit down and, like, I'll teach somebody something, and I'm like, wow, I miss doing that. So I'm going to kind of try to get more involved with that, depending on how much time I have. If we're not working on a new record or we're not touring in the springtime, I wouldn't mind taking on some students or in some way, shape, or form helping somebody out.
That would be amazing. Well, that would be kind of cool. Now, is this one of those things where you're going to do it like, you know, one-on-one in person and stuff? Or is this something that you may actually consider doing online or Skyping or, you know, getting with somebody over the internet?
I don't know. I mean, it's been so long since I did it. I mean, I live up in the mountains in Pennsylvania, so I don't think anybody else lives near me.
So in other words, so Skyping would, yeah, you know, that might work.
That might work, or, you know, I'm trying to also find a couple places in New York City and in New Jersey and Connecticut where, you know, if there's a music school, a couple colleges down in Florida and Texas have asked me to be part of their adjunct faculty.
Oh, cool.
Where I can, like, go down there once a month and just take on a pile of students. I'm not sure. I haven't thought that deep into it, other than I really want to start doing it. Then the logistics is going to be another problem.
I would love to find out when you do. I would. I swear I would. I think that would be cool.
I'll let you know.
Yeah, I think that would. If you're you know you got a bunch of people that are listening, you got a bunch of young musicians and stuff that are tuned in, you know, they want one piece of advice. You only have one chance, one time. You get to give them one piece. What's the piece you give them?
My advice to you would be that if you've enjoyed anything that we've discussed tonight, go to my Facebook page, the musician page.
Perfect.
Right? And I make a point of talking to everybody all the time on that thing. So if you have any questions, if you have any comments, if, you know, you need some advice on something, you know, this is the time in my life where I really want to help people out and give back a little bit more.
Okay.
And that's where there's going to be, like, some teaching and some inside, you know, like, industry things and things like that. You know, come visit me on there. Aside from that, the only advice I can give you is that if you want to do this for a living, be better than everybody else because you have to be.
There it is.
Very good.
There it is. Thank you so much. I know that you guys you've been on a bus ride forever. I heard,
dude, that was 1,100 miles last night. That was fun.
Wow.
You know, I heard you got to catch up on a bunch of reruns. You know,
watched all my old UFC fights.
All that good stuff. Now, you guys have a show. Actually, don't you have a show? Is it Wednesday?
Yeah, Wednesday we pick back up. Here in San Antonio, we got two shows. Dallas on Thursday, two shows, and then Houston on Friday for two shows.
Nice. And then you're going to be off for at least a couple of days and stuff to do some things.
Yeah, Christmas Eve and Christmas Day in Phoenix.
Okay, good deal. I want you guys to be safe. Congratulations on a very, very successful time and a successful tour right now.
Well, thank you so much. I want to thank you so much. I've enjoyed this time with you so much this evening.
Man, I tell you what, anytime you need anything, Al, you let us know, okay?
Hey, back at you, okay? And listen, all my best to you families. Have a great holiday, and I hope to talk to you and see you real soon.
You will,
thank you so
will.
Much, Al.
Thanks so much again, honey.
My pleasure, babe.
Right,
Merry Christmas, guys.
Merry Christmas. Bye-bye. All right, guys. Those of you who've been tuned in, that was Mr. Al Petrelli. You guys know him best, you know, for being the musical director and lead guitarist for Trans-Siberian Orchestra. Of course, you know, Once Upon a Time, Sabotage. What a cool man. Yeah, he was in the mood to talk.
Very cool. Like I said, 1,100 hours trapped on a bus.
1,100 miles, rather. Yeah, yeah.
No, 1,100 miles, sorry.
Yeah. No, I mean, that was fantastic stuff. And, you know, and one of the things, I mean, ultimately, you know, the whole thing that I got from him, you know, other than the fact that it was just, you know, be there and go and do this stuff and, you know, being at the right places at the right times. And a lot of his, you know, opportunities and stuff started with the personal relationship they had with the people at the time. And this, you know, all these cool names and stuff, you know, that he was throwing out that everybody was probably, you know, kind of going, wow, just as much as I was. You know, it wasn't like they were known at the time either. It was all of them really collaborating, all of them really working on some things. And as things moved on, and as he put himself in the right positions in the right places, you know, and so it went. Fantastic time, you know. It was very, very cool, awesome to catch up with him. And of course, you guys know that, you know, he is touring with Trans-Siberian Orchestra. They are in the middle of an incredible time right now. So you do have opportunities if you are keeping up with them. It's the Ghost of Christmas Eve, and it's along with, you know, some of their other greats and stuff, is that they get to play and the best of TSO, if you will. And if you want to catch up with them, you can actually go to trans-siberian.com/tour to find out where they're going to be next. All right. So I think what we need to do is we need to play some more music,
I agree.
Since we've been hanging out, you know, and chit-chatting and things like that. So with no further ado, how about a little Karen Single Band, man? I feel we're going to kind of ease into it. We're going to ride into it. Then we're going to come back out, man. A little bit here in a few minutes, man. We're going to have a little Aleria from Memphis. We got some Lithium coming up for you. Mega Man, Devices Divide Us as You Wish. But first, let's go to Dreamland right here, Memphis Metal Mondays.
The proceeding was produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated and originally aired live on Radio Memphis. Any offers or advertisement contained may not still be valid. All rights are reserved and copyright is held by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. For more, look for all the RMOD players at radio-memphis.com.